MacCast, Tuesday, August 6th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast, back here for another episode, and I have a great one for you because I invited a couple friends over to come chat with us. We do this every once in a while, and I have Mac OS Ken's Ken Ray here, and also David Sparks from the Mac Power Users podcast, also MacSparky.com. They came in. I wanted to talk about some of the latest news that's been going on, but also invite them in on some of the conversations that we've been having here on the MacCast about a couple different topics. So it was a lot of fun to get them on and just chat back and forth about all these things, and I hope you really enjoy it. But before we get into that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast, and I am super excited to have them as a sponsor because I love their application, Busy Mac, makers of BusyCal. BusyCal has been my default calendar on my Mac for years. I transitioned over from Apple's calendar app. It was seamless, and I never looked back. I am a BusyCal user to the end. I think at this point, there's no way you're going to have to rip it out of my cold, dead Mac, I guess, as it were. But if you've ever wanted a little bit more out of your calendar app, or maybe a whole lot more out of your calendar app than what's offered in the built-in one, you should take a look at BusyCal. It imports all your data from calendar. It keeps everything in sync, and it is not locking you in. You can switch between calendar or BusyCal, go back and forth. You don't have to worry about your data and your information. It's all in there. It just syncs up. It supports iCloud and Google Calendar and CalDAV servers, and they just released a new public beta version 2.5 that is bringing in Exchange support. So if you're an Exchange user, you're going to be able to use BusyCal as well, and that's available right now. It has a ton of great features that you can fully customize and change and make the calendar work the way you want it to. One of my favorite features, and it's really a simple one, something that we lost in calendars, is a non-modal info panel. So just like the old iCal, I can edit my events without having to open up another window or a panel. It's just right down there in the sidebar, and I love that. You can scroll different ways, so you can have month-to-month scrolling through week views, and you can customize the number of weeks that are shown in your month view. And something that I just discovered is that you can also scroll through the month view incrementally a week at a time. So rather than going from month to month, you can just add a week, go forward a week or back a week within the month view if you just hold down the option key while you're scrolling. So that's great when you get near the end of the month and you just want to see maybe what's in the first or second week of the next month. You can do that. You also get all of your to-dos in your calendar. It syncs with reminders, so you don't have to have those separated anymore. And you can even show your dated to-dos if you want, right there in your calendar view, right on the date when you have to do them, which is really, really handy. With alarms, you can set up custom snooze times. So it's not just a default when you snooze that thing away. You can set up a specific time when you want to be reminded of that alarm. And you also get really cool features like weather during the week of your app. It's integrated into the calendar. You can also show your moon phases. You can add graphics. So if you want to mark birthdays or holidays or special events with a little image to call them out, you can set that up. And everything is customizable, optional. You configure it the way you want your calendar to be. It really is, I think, the ultimate calendar app for the Mac, and you should check it out. They have a free 30-day trial on their website. You can go there and download it from busymac.com, or you can buy it on the Mac App Store or through the website. So check it out if you haven't. BusyCal from BusyMac, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So what do you say we jump into the show? Here was my conversation with my friends Ken Ray and David Sparks. So hey, Ken, how you doing?
Live long and prosper, Adam. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. This isn't one of the Star Trek shows, is it? My bad. Hey, Adam. I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good. Good. Glad to have you back with me for another MacCast. I appreciate you taking the time to lend your voice.
Absolutely. Always fun.
And Dave Sparks. Dave, how are you doing?
the Force will be with me.
Always. Oh, we're already doing that. Now we've got the whole Star Wars, Star Trek thing going on.
Fanboys with my 11-year-old. It was so fun. Have you guys seen that movie, Fanboys?
No.
Oh, you have to see it.
I think I have.
It's made for geeks.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
A guy's dying of cancer, and they decide, him and his buddies decide, they're going to drive across the country, sneak onto Lucas's ranch, and watch episode one before it releases, you know, before the guy dies.
Right.
And
I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, they have run-ins with Trekkies. It's so fun.
Now, what I want to see, actually, is The People versus George Lucas. It's in my Netflix queue.
I saw that. Yeah,
I've watched it.
It's interesting. They're all interesting. Hey, but I mean,
and just one last point. Hand shot first. Just that's all.
Totally, absolutely. I don't know. I don't know if this is what got me onto Mission Log or not. But Rod Roddenberry, the last time I saw him at Macworld, so Macworld 2012 was the last one that I got to go to. Said he just didn't care. He's like, I know I'm probably going to excommunicate myself from this group, but I just don't care who shot first. And I stayed quiet for as long as I could, which I believe was about 37 seconds, and said, look, it's a story of redemption until Han shoots first. Then it's just a bad Western. And he, you know.
Yeah.
Then he asked me if I wanted to do a mission log. So maybe that was it. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, we're due for... you know, what do they call this crossover? I mean, if we're going to have Batman and Superman, right, and you've got the same director doing both, it's time for crossover.
No, that doesn't make any sense. We can't have this conversation.
Totally yeah. So we're throwing out ridiculous things.
We finally get to see the Enterprise versus the Death Star. Is that what you're saying?
You kind of saw that with the answer board, all those, but anyway.
All those, they're going to just go in and answer all those debates.
Let's not talk about Mac stuff. Let's not talk about
let's
Apple.
Talk about
let's just,
nerdy, geeky,
sci-fi
stuff.
Yeah, to hear John Starting Williams is going to score the next. Going to score the next.
No, let's talk about some Mac things. We have a bunch of stuff to go over, and I already mentioned I want to you guys that I want to get your opinions on some of the things that we've talked about recently here on the MacCast. So just get some other knowledgeable voices in the fray like we like to do. So I appreciate you both coming on. But let's get to some of the latest stories that are going on. One that I didn't dive into yet, that I think, well, this was just a couple days ago. The DOJ made a proposal for what they're going to do or what they want to have happen to Apple in this whole ebook price fixing thing. And I half wanted to get this on the show, Dave, because, you know, you having lived in the iBooks world, I'm very curious to hear what you have to say about it. But the overall, the sort of five key points, and I think these were outlined by an Apple Insider piece that I read. I'm looking at this thing going, this is just a proposal at this point. It's not anything, and Apple's in the process of appealing the ruling, and there's a long way to go still on this. But this proposal just seemed outrageous to me.
Like step one, pull down your pants.
It just seemed like they're going to cut Apple off at the knees. I mean, it's just like you're out of ebooks. Forget it. You know, if you ever had any hope of this being part of your business, good luck, because this is what we want to have happen. One, they want them to terminate all the agreements with the five publishers that they had in place. So I guess that's the current agreements that are using the catalog model or whatever model they ended up doing on. And then they said they had to refrain from entering any new ebook distribution contracts for the next 5 years. And then that they couldn't, quote unquote, serve as a conduit of information among the conspiring publishers or from retaliating against publishers for refusing to sell ebooks on agency terms. So I guess agency terms is the stuff that Amazon uses, right?
No, the agency model is the one where Apple came to the publishers and said, hey, you know, name your own price. We want 30%. That's the agency model. Okay. What Amazon was doing, and I guess is continuing to do, is the wholesale model where Amazon will pay however much, you know, whatever the wholesale price is, and then they charge whatever they want to.
Charge whatever they want. Okay, so thank you for clarifying that, because I always get it mixed up. And then they want them to extend this sort of stuff into, hey, you can't do anything with the music, movie, TV, games companies that would increase prices for competitors. So pretty much, you know, messing up their models in other forms of media. And then one that I'm actually a little bit for, although I don't like the fact that it would be a forced sort of thing, but I never understood this very much anyway, was allowing other ebook retailers to actually sell books through their apps. To me, that's just a convenience thing for consumers. I'd like to see that. I know, you know, that we can get the content into Amazon and Barnes & Noble apps on the iPad and the iPhone, but...
Well, no, they're allowed to do that now.
No, they're allowed to do that now, but they can't sell.
They just have to share the... No, they are allowed to. You're right. But they have to share, and they didn't want to share. No, I mean, they were allowed to do it the whole time. I mean, and so this, again, is where... I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, yes, I wish that they would do that. I understand Apple saying, you know, give me a cut. And I understand the book publishers saying, well, I don't want to give you a cut. That's where it feels to me like the DOJ is being a little heavy-handed on the whole thing. They're basically forcing Apple to abandon their established business model. This is not even like, you know, an anti-collusion kind of thing.
Right.
Or an anti-competitive kind of thing. This is, you know, what we really want is for you to just run your business differently. I mean, it's not just about protecting consumers. It doesn't seem to be at this point. It starts to be a little punitive. Now, maybe they put that one on there, though, so they could take it off the table. Who knows?
Right.
And well, it's a settlement offer. It's, you know, and Apple turned it down. So that's a dead story, really. So they wanted you to do these things, and they're not going to do them.
This isn't a settlement offer. This is the remedy phase that the DOJ is proposing. When they go Friday, the DOJ is going to argue these are the things that Apple should have to do as part of the. Go ahead.
But that's the judge's job, is to decide what that is. What their demands are, you know, doesn't matter.
Right, right. I mean, these are just proposals, right? This is what they're going to tell the judge they want him to do, not necessarily what he is going to do, right?
I have intentionally kind of stayed out of this whole thing because I know just enough about the underlying laws to be dangerous. I don't know it that well. I don't know the facts that well of this thing. In fact, when I saw it, you put it in the outline.
Yeah.
By the way, Adam, you have to start putting my outlines in 18 points because 12 points just isn't working for me.
Oh, yeah. I think that was the export on them. I should have just sent you the markdown file. Sorry.
But when I saw the outline, I was like, do I want to talk about it? Well, this is – okay, so here's my, you know, here's my one-paragraph summary. So Amazon has a deal where they buy a product for $12 and they sell it at a loss for $10, basically driving a lot of people out of business. Apple has a deal where they buy a product. Well, they don't buy a product. They let you sell a product for whatever price you want, and they take a cut for being the middleman.
Right.
But Apple is anti-competitive, and Amazon is just fine.
Well, and I mean, that was sort of where I wanted to get to on this story. Not so much these details, because that was sort of the lead-in to the conversation I wanted to have, which is, you know, doesn't this in essence perpetuate, and I put it as Amazon's de facto sort of monopoly power over the ebook market, and more on the consumer side is what I'm thinking of, right? They're making prices that consumers are then going to demand to the point where really what is anybody else supposed to do?
And who's going to write books when, you know, what happens when there's nobody left? Because, you know, whether it's a court order or just... you know, running out of business like all the brick and mortar stores are doing. At some point, there's going to be nobody left to sell books except Amazon. And what happens when Amazon says, you know what, guys, we aren't paying you $12 anymore. We'll pay you $5 for that book.
Right.
And then what happens to the authors and what happens to the book companies? I think, I don't know. And see, I don't know enough about it. I'm sure somebody listening to this can say I'm wrong about 12 different ways, but just from a common sense perspective, I don't understand how what Amazon is doing could be legal. But, you know, that's just my two cents, I guess. So I have a really hard time just absorbing what's going on here. And granted, I know Apple will take it. They're masters at pressing the advantage. And it's very likely that they used their power and other media to force booksellers that have other interests to come in. And maybe they did some wrong things in the process, but overall there's one company here that's selling a product at a price set by the people who are selling it, and if people don't want to pay the extra money, then they don't buy the books. And then there's another company that's selling it intentionally at a loss in a way that is forcing its competitors out of business. And everybody's pointing to them like the, you know, the mountaintop. Like they're the ones that are the good guys on all this. So I just don't understand.
Amazon is a very weird company. Philip Elmer DeWitt, I think it is, at Fortune recently, you know, pointed to the fact that Apple beat estimates and took in like however many billions of dollars last quarter, and they got a little bit of a bounce. Amazon lost money, but they beat analyst estimates. They didn't lose
as much
money as analysts had expected them to lose, and so that's considered a beat. And so they see like this gigantic next day trading because Amazon's doing better.
Well, if they have a government authorized monopoly that is in 10 years going to be an absolute monopoly and perfectly legal, maybe you should be buying their stock. You know,
that is, I don't know. They're a crazy, crazy company. I don't understand. Yeah. I don't get it.
Well, and so getting back to this, I mean, when all this fallout happens, and I have no idea, you know, what's going to come out of this at this point. But I mean, if I'm just looking at these recommendations going, if any of these are even close to something that the judge decides to do, I mean, really, where does that leave Apple's iBook business? I mean, can they even have a business after that? Or is it just throw your hands up, or does this even matter? And that's what I'm wondering about. I mean, does this impact Apple's book business, or is it just one of those speed bumps on the road to, you know, them just doing stuff differently?
Apple's a really big company, and they've got some really smart people, and they have literally dump trucks full of $1,000 bills. So,
well, that's
whatever happens
that's what
here, they'll figure a way out.
Right? Yeah. So, like at the end of the day, you know, this stuff's going to happen, and we read these reports about it and stuff like that. But they'll figure out a way to continue the iBook business and continue providing opportunities for guys like you, right, Dave? I'm assuming this isn't going to change.
Well, I mean, this is dealing with with five different publishing companies, and you know, Max Sparky Publishing was not in the court order, so
you're okay.
I'll be happy to just keep selling my books through Apple.
Well, it's not like they can't keep doing what they're doing. I mean, right. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to go ahead and buy from iBooks anyway because they like iBooks as opposed to Amazon, or because they like iBooks as opposed to Nook. I mean, and I will say the only I use actually the Nook app right now, but it's only because somebody gave me a lot of money on a Barnes & Noble gift card for Christmas, which is great. Otherwise, they've got a very kludgy app. They've got an app that just does not feel quite as good as the Kindle app, which does not feel quite as good as the Apple app. So, I mean, if the price was the same across all three of those, then I don't guess it would matter to anybody what they were using. You may actually end up with somebody doing something that differentiates their product from other products. For a while, I was actually using the Amazon iBooks, the Amazon Kindle app over the iBooks app because I like the whole sharing aspect of it. I like the fact that I can make notes and, you know, those notes would post online and other people can look at those notes and, you know, post to it as well. Okay, that's a fun thing. Differentiation in this, and I know it's kind of a crazy thing to think about because nobody's really had to differentiate in books. I mean, since somebody said, hey, you know what 68-year-olds would probably like? Bigger print. Okay, let's go with that. You know, and before that, it was the paperback. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of, like, innovation in the physical book space. When you're dealing with ebooks, you do have, you know, the chance to really do some innovative things, it seems to me, even if it's just tweaking the interface. And so maybe Apple is able to go ahead and win on that. Now, the other thing is 5 years feels like a long time to me and to you.
Right.
To a company. 5 years is, I mean, they've got products sitting on their table right now going, in 7 years, everybody's going to have one of those. You know what I mean? So, like,
fair point.
Five years.
Well, we definitely benefit from having Apple and Amazon slugging it out. I mean, I was seriously looking at self-publishing for a while before the paperless book came out. And, you know, at one point, there was no self-publishing model at Apple. There was no iBook store. It was just Amazon. And at that point, the cut for the author, it was a 70-30 cut, and the author got 30. So if I had put the book out through Amazon, I was going to get 30% of each sale. And then Apple comes out and says, well, the cut's going to be 70-30, but the author gets 70. And guess what happened at Amazon? Like, within, if memory serves, within weeks, They flipped it. So now Amazon, the authors, get 70%. And, you know, so that's my fear, is that we're only going to have one company as the conduit for this type of information. And as authors, we're all going to get, you know, we're going to get hosed. So I don't want that to happen. I don't want Apple to be the only company. I don't want Amazon to be the only company. But at a fundamental level, I still don't understand how what Amazon is doing is okay, or can be kosher, when you've got, you know, a company that is taking a loss just because it's big enough to take the loss, and driving competitors that are selling a legitimate, you know, product for a profit out of business.
Can I try this one?
Yeah.
5 years ago, 7 years ago, 10 years ago, nobody cared about digital. There wasn't real money there. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's cute.
Right.
That's why digital, I mean, that's why advertising online, it seems to me, has always been backwards, because you need so many clicks to make any kind of real money. But you've got people there. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you've got people in a way that TV ads don't, but TV is serious. Print is serious. And so they still command top dollar for those things, even though we've got Hopper, so we can fast forward through it. Or I can get up and go to the fridge and get a beer while the ads are on. I mean, we have had 50, 60 years of training ourselves. And I mean, in mass media, I mean, not any of us here on this, but we've had 50 or 60 years of training ourselves to ignore advertising. A click on a website ought to be worth more than the idea that I'm going to remember, you know, the 30-second ad between that other 30-second ad and the other one. But it's not, because we didn't take, digital was not taken seriously initially. Same thing with ebooks. I mean, seriously, I'm Doubleday, right? And I've got a warehouse full of books. Is Doubleday even a publisher anymore? I don't know.
Don't know.
I'm Doubleday.
Right.
And I've got a warehouse full of books, and you're Jeff Bezos, and you come to me and say, guess what I'm going to do for you? You're not going to believe it, but you're going to love it. I'm going to buy digital copies of those books for the same price that I would buy those physical books. Don't worry about what I'm going to do with them. I'm going to pay you for nothing, for literally, physically nothing. Digitize this. That's going to cost you something. But otherwise, physically nothing, I'm going to give you $12. And everybody's like, wow, because I had no use for that before. That wasn't even money before. And then Bezos goes and sells it for $9 or $10. And still the publisher is thinking, this is fantastic. I'm getting $12 for nothing. But the problem is then mass market started catching up with digital. And suddenly people are saying, I mean, yeah, it's neat to have the book and it looks great on the shelves, but it's $23 and I can get it for $9.99. And now people are convinced that that's how much a book is worth.
Right.
$9.99. And that's where it gets screwed up. Bezos, hats off to him, saw the future.
Yeah.
And he was willing to totally bend people over to get to it.
You know,
that's kind of the problem.
And to go forward your 5 years, where do we stand? I mean, it could be pretty ugly for authors.
Yes. Oh, and booksellers. I mean, please, how is it that we are now down to one major bookselling chain and they are constantly having to tighten their belt? There's one place now that you can go. And I mean, with the exception of like the little mom and pop bookstores, but I have a hard time going to them because they don't even charge me as little as Barnes & Noble charges me, which doesn't charge me as little as Amazon does. Yeah. You know?
Right.
And there aren't many of those mom and pop places anymore either.
Hey, it's me, Adam. We'll get right back to the episode, but I did want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, we've got the fall coming up. There's going to be all kinds of new crazy Mac Apple gadgets out, and if you're like me, you're going to want some of those, but maybe you need a little bit of extra cash to make that purchase. Before you upgrade, what you might want to do is sell your used phone or gadget that you are going to no longer be needing for cash over at gazelle.com. And you can find out how much that item is worth by going to gazelle.com today. Gazelle makes selling your gadgets really fast and simple. You just go to gazelle.com. You do a little search for your item, tell them a little bit about the condition. They'll actually even buy broken iPhones and iPods. And right there, you will get a risk-free offer for your gadgets. And you can lock that in for 30 days. So that means you can actually go to Gazelle, get the offer, know how much cash you're going to get before you buy your new item. And then after you get the new device, send it in and get your cash back once you've transferred everything over. And they'll take care of cleaning off your device, removing any old data. And once they receive your item and check it out, you'll get paid fast by PayPal. Or you can get an extra 5% if you choose to get paid by Amazon gift card. And now Gazelle is actually buying back a larger selection of tablets. So in addition to the iPad, you can also sell Gazelle select Samsung, Google, Nexus, Kindle Fire, and Microsoft Surface, as well as Asus tablets. So maybe you have one of those old tablets, you want to upgrade to a new iPad, you can check it out on Gazelle. And you're going to want to do it today, or as soon as you know that you want to sell your old device, because every day that you wait, your gadgets might be losing value. So go get your offer, find out what your iPhone, your iPad, your Samsung, or other smartphone, as well as your tablets are worth. Just take a minute to go to gazelle.com and find out. And a big thank you to Gazelle for their support of the MacCast. And now let's get back to the conversation with Dave and Ken. I'm going to jump way ahead in our notes, because the kind of stuff that you're talking about, I want to move on to the next topic, and the kind of stuff you're talking about are the kinds of things that are running through my head, at least from a pricing model perspective and a viability of a business model perspective, that I've been talking about on the MacCast for a while now. And it's concerns over how Mac developers and software developers are going to continue to do sustainable businesses in this sort of what seems to me like this race to the bottom kind of pricing, and a sort of shakeup of their entire app ecosystem that really started with Apple with iOS apps and has progressed into Mac apps. And it's great for consumers because we get great low-cost prices on apps, but it brings with it, I think, a lot of baggage. And I think at this point, what I talked about on the last show was what I was calling sort of the app new world order. And I think originally I was thinking this thing is horrible, this is a bad thing, this race to the bottom sort of thing. How are developers going to survive this? And then I suddenly realized that I think I was being a bit hypocritical, because I did the same thing in reverse to sort of talking about things like 99-cent songs and music and those sorts of things, right? Those guys had their whole world turned upside down by iTunes way back when, and now they're starting to figure out the models, and you know, music is making money from what I understand. I don't know if it's as much money as before, and we may see a similar sort of thing with apps and software. But what triggered this was there were kind of two pieces that I read this last week. One was from Gideon Mayhew from Icon Factory, and he was talking about iOS 7 specifically, and this being a good time for app developers to put out new versions of their apps and sort of recharge for them. And what this is addressing is the whole app model of, hey, we don't have a way to do paid for upgrades anymore, right? The iOS apps and the Mac App Store, you pay the price, and then you get upgrades for, you know, updates for free of that app. And so what a number of developers have started to do is, you know, just release whole new versions of the same app. So we had, you know, Tweety, I think, and Tweety 2, or, you know, there's examples like that. I think Pixelmator did this recently, right? They came out with a whole new version, and you just rebuy the app. And yeah, so he was proposing.
PDF Pen did that too.
PDF Pen does that. And that's one of these new world order app models that I think developers are having to migrate to. And Rene Ritchie sort of followed this up with a piece over on iMore that was really interesting, where he pointed to the new music app that Apple just updated. Why am I blanking?
Logic Pro.
Logic Pro 10, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Logic Pro 10 comes out, and it's basically buy the new app, but the pricing is the what used to be the upgrade pricing for Logic Pro. And so his thing was another one of these new sort of world order things is that when these new apps come out, the pricing, new pricing seems to be always upgrade pricing, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to sell you the original, the first time you buy it, you're going to be paying what used to be sort of the upgrade price, and then the next time we come out with a major new revision, you'll just pay that price again, which is an interesting concept. And then after I did that, somebody from my show commented that as far as, you know, offering loyalty programs for people who buy the apps, the other thing that we're seeing and he actually likes is when a developer releases a new version of their app and it's a new, you got to pay, you know, pay again for this app. And we saw this, I think, with Smile, if I'm remembering correctly, with PDF Pen, is for a couple weeks, you get the even lower price to jump in, but yeah, everybody gets that. And so some people are complaining that, well, that doesn't, you know, reward the loyal customer who's paid and paid and paid, and now the new guy's getting a brand new thing. But the flip side of that argument is, well, now developers have a way to hook people in, get the app, and then if we move to this new idea of, hey, next time a major new revision comes out, you're just going to pay this price again, they've built up a customer base. They've built up. And so I'm starting to look at this and going, okay, this is really just a shift in how we're sort of going to sell software, as opposed to, well, Apple's eroding, completely eroding the whole, you know, pricing model. I honestly, I've had lots of conversation with developers who, you know, we're kind of just, we're figuring this out, and I guess it's a little scary, I guess is what I'm getting at, right?
Well, as a consumer, it was scary for me, and I guess I'm more into this than a lot of people, but there's some software I really love, and it's software that you can't make and sell for $2. It's software that, you know, right, like PDF Pen is an example, where there's a whole team of people working on that. There's a whole nother team of people there to answer your question when you're using it and you have a question. And, you know, there's a lot of overhead to make something really great. And one fear I had when all this started to, you know, happen was, what's going to happen to companies like Smile that make a good product, but they can't sell a product for $2 and stay in business? Does it mean that we're going to have not just a race to the bottom in pricing, but just, you know, a failure of quality software? And I think, like you, Adam, I'm hoping that they'll figure it out. And, you know, the thing is, Apple kind of cheats, because Apple makes, you know, the dump trucks full of $1,000 bills on the hardware.
Right,
so,
right.
So they can sell something like Final Cut or some of these other applications that are worth much more than they charge for them, and they'll sell them at a loss. Now, you know, they're doing exactly what I was just complaining about Amazon doing. The smaller people, it seems like they're starting to figure it out, and let's just hope they do. I, as a consumer, I'm willing to pay for PDF Pen every 2 or 3 years. You know, so long as they deliver with something new and make it better and make, you know, give me a reason. And there's apps out there that I will pay for multiple times, and I'm okay with that. I mean, the plus side, as you said, is that things are cheaper now. I mean, I remember buying apps for my Palm Pilot. They were like $60 that didn't do anything.
Right.
Except, you know, they'd fix some feature that was already broken in the phone. So,
right.
So, you know, it is cheaper, and everybody should just, you know, gulp it down and pay once in a while for this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, and there's other things that I haven't brought into here that developers are dealing with that concern me, you know, things like Cloneware. You got a lot of that going on. You have the guy that's going to come in and make an app that's functionally similar and then, you know, give it away for free or sell it for a tenth the price and just hope that, you know, people buy that thing. But I think consumers are smart enough to long-term sort of figure that out and find the quality software and stuff like that. And I also, several people pointed out to me, well, you know, developers make a lot of money and, you know, I personally think this pricing is fine and we shouldn't have to worry about them. But I think the thing I need to point out is that, you know, when we're talking about these companies that do develop a great app and then they have a staff and they have support people. This is not the guy who's earning a, you know, few thousand dollars on the side making an app and he's perfectly happy doing that. That's a whole nother part of this new app world order that I think is great. Right, there's a whole bunch of developers who maybe don't want to be full-time developers, don't have a lot of time to spend on this stuff, and they supplement it. They have a day job where they're doing programming and making those kinds of salaries. But when you go full-time and you start doing this yourself, you have to have a viable, you know, model that can sustain your business long-term. It's one thing to have one hit and make a ton of money, but you start when you're one guy by yourself, right, and you make that great app and then suddenly there's 100,000, 200,000, millions of copies out there, guess what you start getting right after that? All those support calls, and people want new versions and they want updates and they want And those are the kinds of things that are going to start, you know, eating into your bottom line. You've got to hire people. And
1-star reviews, you know, for it would be great if you could change the font.
Right.
Things along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, can you keep the old version? I guess that's the question I have.
Well, that's the other, I mean, that's another dilemma of this sort of new world order when it comes to apps. Yes, you can. And oftentimes the old version is still on sale in the store right alongside the new version. Because it has to sit there so that you can push updates and bug fixes and patches for all those customers that already have it. It's a new dilemma that developers are having to deal with, right? I don't think you can just take that off the App Store, because what happens when I rebuild my phone and I need to reinstall my copy of, you know, the version 1 of that app that I bought that still runs?
Oh, it should still be there, shouldn't it? It seems to me that there's a game that somebody advertised, and forgive me, I don't usually like to do anything else while we're on the phone, but there was a game that one of my listeners actually developed and then advertised with me.
Uh-huh.
That is no longer, I don't think it's available. It was called Demonless. It is no longer available, I don't believe, on the App Store, which I was kind of surprised to see and kind of sad to see, because I know, you know, it was a fun game. It was a little addictive, I thought. Which was a huge part of my ad for it.
So can a developer remove it and then still have it be available in the purchase? Is that what you're saying? So,
I know it still shows up as like one of my purchased apps. Oh, okay. Yeah, because I did have to download it one time.
Apple's accounted for that scenario. Which just further goes to promote the fact that this is how we're defining, and Apple's defining, this is how we're going to sell software in the future.
Hey, you know, never mind. It's actually still on the App Store, so never mind.
Yeah.
That's no answer, it turns out, to your question. I apologize. They may
have to do that. You know, I don't know. But the thing is I think where I'm going with this is exactly what I said at the beginning. I'm sort of coming to grips, and I think developers are starting to come to grips with, you know what, this is the way we sell software now.
Right.
It's not that old way. And I was sort of one of those folks that was clinging on to the old model. It's like, we got to hold on to this old model. This new stuff is, I don't like this. And there's still parts of it I don't like. I don't like that the way you get a free trial is you build a light version of your app. I don't like some of the newer models that are cropping up. But, you know, again, that's just me. And I'm going to be able to buy from the developers that don't have a certain model. And the models I'm talking about are, you know, where it's free and then everything in the app is I constantly have to buy something. As a matter of fact, I just downloaded an app like that. And it's a really fun app from Linden Labs. I love some of the stuff they do. As a matter of fact, Creatorverse, I think, is one of my favorite apps that they've done recently. But they came out with a new one that's like a brick building Lego kind of app where you can build these cool, pretty much anything you want with different bricks and objects and stuff like that. And then there's physics involved, and so you can actually make them move, so you can create cars and planes and all kinds of stuff. And it's super fun, and it's free. But it's free, and all of your bricks are sort of limited, right? So you have, you know, a dozen square bricks or 50 square bricks and this many rectangles and that many circles and so many wheels and what have you. And then once you've used them all up in your world, you have to buy packs and you have to buy more. Or either that or destroy the stuff that you've built and rebuilt it. So they're like literally virtual versions of Legos. And so my immediate reaction was, look, this is horrible. This is awful. You know, why would you do this? But then at the same time, I thought, well, you know what? If I was buying Legos, guess what? This is exactly the experience I would have. But it's a real world experience, so I put more value on that than on the digital experience.
Well, I mean, because Lego, I mean, each individual Lego actually costs more money.
Exactly.
I mean, literally somewhere along the line, each one of those cost the Lego Corporation something to make. I mean,
right.
You know,
but again,
a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a penny, sure. But
we're talking the new world order, right? The world is moving digital. And
well,
you know, it's not surprising that we're seeing these things tried out and consumers will ultimately decide. Now, for me, that's not an app that I'm going to keep on my thing. I have no interest in that model. But I can fully recognize that there's going to be a ton of people that love this thing and they collect everything virtually and they don't want the physical bricks and they're perfectly fine. Fine to live in that world, right? So
that it seems to me that at that point is just a question of, are they pricing them reasonably? I mean, if it's a fun enough game And if they're selling enough, I mean, then there are going to be some people who, like you say, are just going to say, well, nuts to this. I wanted unlimited bricks. It doesn't cost them anymore to give me unlimited bricks. So this is just stupid.
Yep.
You know, there are going to be other people who are going to say, well, that's a reasonable amount of money to pay for a reasonable number of bricks. I mean, it's going to be a matter of, you know, striking that balance. It seems to me.
Yeah. And they're going to have to find their way. And that's what I think we're seeing, right? It's just a lot of experimentation on this. And, you know, I sent them some feedback that I didn't like the model, and, you know, and maybe others will, and maybe others will say, well, I like that model, and that's okay.
Hey, who was it a couple of years ago that Alyssa Milano got upset with, and then everybody got upset with Alyssa Milano? Because this was actually a debate that was happened a while ago.
It was one of the tweet apps. I think it was. I don't remember which one it was.
I don't remember which one it was either.
It might have been Lauren Brichter's app, but didn't Tweety do that?
Tweety?
I think it was Tweety, but I'm not sure.
I think it was something like they had a new version and, you know, brought a whole bunch of new features with it. And so they said, hey, guess what? This is going to cost more because
you got to rebuy it. Yeah.
This is how we do it. And Alyssa Milano, who, I mean, you know, she's not like Tom Cruise rich, but she's not average iPhone owner, not rich either.
She can afford $3.
Yeah. Complained about the $1.99, $2.99, whatever it was. And initially, people were like, yeah. And then a whole host of geeks, because it turns out, guess who's following Alyssa Milano on Twitter? Right. We're like, excuse me. How long do you think your one payment of $2.99 is going to last that group of people trying to get by? And, you know, all the extra work that they did. So, I mean...
Yeah, $2.99 before Apple gets its 30%.
Before Apple gets its 30%, right. It yeah. seems like...
It was Tweety. Yeah, I just looked it up.
If everybody does this, then everybody's going to hate it, but everybody's going to understand. If a couple of developers do this, then a couple of developers are probably going to get a really bad name with consumers for a little while.
Yeah.
And then the question becomes, do all the other developers go ahead and start doing it? Because it turns out even though that developer got a bad name, they also got a lot more money.
Exactly.
Or maybe Apple gets all the developers together in a room and says, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah. No, that's not going to happen.
Tim Cook sends an email out to everybody.
Developers would hope that would happen, I think, so they could have Apple's ear for a couple of minutes, but no. Yeah.
Well, actually, I was joking about the anti-competitive possibilities there.
No, I got it. I do get that.
Well, you know, I'm dealing with that with my books, my field guides. You know, these are self-published books, and I'm updating them. Paperless is on version, I think, 1.4 now. Mm-hmm. And so I spend a significant amount of time going back and updating and adding new and recording new screencasts, and it's a living book, you know. So if you get it, you're not getting the one-year-old version. You're getting probably the two-month-old version. And I'm going to do that for a couple of years, but at some point, I'm going to have a second edition. And
yeah,
if you want
that,
you're going to have to pay for it. I can't do that for 10 years. You know, at some point, you're going to have to pay again.
Yeah, in perpetuity, and, you know, and also people have to remember another thing with the App Store that I think a lot of people often forget is all pricing, and this is this way on books too, right, Dave? Is all of it is family pricing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not just one copy. You can put that on every device that you have in your family.
Well, mine are all DRM free, so, you know, people do more than that.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, but I mean, so for that privilege, we have to also recognize that, you know what, occasionally we've got to buy a new version so that there's an incentive for these developers to want to continue developing. Because otherwise, it's just like, why, like you're saying, why bother? Am I supposed to just have support and put out new versions in perpetuity? Is that right?
Perpetuity.
There you go.
Yeah. You're thinking of pituitary. That's a whole other thing entirely.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Well, I think it seems like there's progress made. And,
yes.
And companies that we love are coming out with new versions of software, and they're not shuttering. So that's a good sign, right?
Well, that's what I said. I think we're starting to figure this out. And that's sort of, you know, as these articles were coming out and I was thinking more and more about this, it's like, okay, this is... We're going to get these new models. People are going to try things, and we're going to find what consumers accept and what they sort of don't, you know, what they want to rail against. So
maybe just like put a year number at the end of it. And that may sound completely stupid, but maybe just put a year number at the end of it. So like Twitterific 2013, right? And then Twitterific 2015, because we got used to paying for Windows 95, Windows 98. We got used to paying for, you know, or some sort of progression.
Yeah, I think
OS 10, 10.8, OS 10, 10.9, like that kind of thing.
I think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 works perfectly. perfectly fine. And that seems to be what a lot of the developers are doing, you know, that, hey, this is version 2. I think that's what Pixelmator just did, right?
Yeah.
Pixelmator 2, 3, 4, have you. But it is interesting, you know, the idea that, you know, the initial price, the sort of price to jump in is likely going to be lower, but then you'll just, you know, repay when those new features come out. And I think I'm perfectly happy to do that. You know, if it means I get to have the great software that we've always had, because that was my primary concern, is if suddenly, you know, Smile or whoever it is has to take an app that they were selling for $30 and sell it for $10. You know, they just lost a third of their profit, and it's not like it takes any less time, or two thirds of their profit, excuse me. And it's not like it takes any time, less time to develop that software. You know, that has, that side of it hasn't changed. Right. Right.
Right. Well, and, you know, the flip side of this is with the Mac App Store, I think there's a much bigger market of people buying software. And so these developers are doing better in that regard because the quantities are higher.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I would also say, I mean, it depends on the kind of app, too, which may sound crazy. But, I mean, the stuff that comes from Smile is productivity stuff. And I think people are used to paying a certain amount of money for productivity stuff. And so they might be more willing to pay a higher upgrade price or a higher, you know, repurchase price than somebody who's buying, you know, whatever the version of Twitter is. Anybody who's, like, you know, that upset about that is probably not buying Smile stuff anyway. I mean, they're probably buying something that will, pretty much do what they want it to do. Yeah, I wish it did this, but, you know, it was free. I've got the little ad at the bottom, but it's free. Or, you know, it was only this amount of money. And no, it's not as full-featured, but it does as much as I want it to do. I mean, somebody who's going to go, I mean, not that Smile is charging Adobe prices, but, I mean, somebody who's going to go, you know, Smile's level is probably going to be okay going Smile's level again.
Well,
it really is. I think it's much more different with sort of like something that's for the casual user. I mean, something like a Twitter thing or
right.
You know, well, IMDb or something like that.
Yeah, like my friend who has the scanner app on his phone that puts the watermark on every receipt he scans because he's too cheap to spend $2.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting that you mentioned Adobe, you know, Adobe prices in that thing too. The thing is Adobe isn't even charging Adobe prices anymore, and Microsoft doesn't plan to either. They're moving into this new app world order in a different way, which is the subscriptionware model. Right?
Yeah, it's like that.
I hate it too, but it's another new model, and it solves this problem of, hey, we've got to compete in a lower, you know, more price sensitive market, and we are going to make up our money some way. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to rent you the software, and you're just going to pay every year. You're going to pay less every year. And really, is that any different than what we were just talking about, where a developer every 12 to 18 months brings out version 2 and charges you another full price, you know, a new lower full price, but a new full price for that app?
Well, sure, because you've always got the option of staying with the one that you've got.
Sure.
I mean,
that is the big difference, right? But fundamentally, you know, it's sort of the same kind of raw payment scheme. If you want to be running the latest version, I guess I should.
If you want to be running the latest. Well, but except you're never going to have that option again, right? I got probably the last box of software I will ever own, is my guess, is Adobe Audition 5.5. And the reason I got 5.5 when I did was because I knew they were going subscription for 6. I mean, and so the thing is, once I do that, right, once I give up that physical copy or once I give up that downloaded version, I'm not going to have the option of just sticking with the old one again. I hate
like 90 days and then it won't work, right?
I hate what Microsoft has done with Skype now. Every time or every other time I open up Skype now, it says, hey, congratulations, you've got the latest version. I didn't ask for the latest version. I didn't necessarily want the latest version. How do I know that you're not going to bork my recording stuff? Well, they don't care because they just want me to have the latest version for whatever reason. So far, it has not screwed up my recording stuff, and I'm very glad about that. But, I mean, I don't want to sound curmudgeonly. I don't want to sound old man. But if I've got something that works for me, I want to be able to hold on to it regardless of your, you know, your business model. And I will probably use Audition 5.5 as long as it is still compatible with whatever computer I own.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it won't be at some point, right?
Yeah, someday.
And see, the subscription model, I think, is really limited to a specific group of apps. It's something where it's almost already universal, that there's this big audience that needs it. And right. they have the ability to do that. I don't think there's going to be many companies that can successfully move to that.
No. Well, and I'm guessing, I don't know. A lot of people I know who didn't really, what I think it, I think you're exactly right. I guess what I'm getting at as I stumble into that. Because everybody I know who sort of had Photoshop because it was Photoshop, but not necessarily because it was critical to their business, mm-hmm. made the choice when that sort of announcement came out that finally said, you know what, I've been toying with not having Photoshop and using something else for a while. I'm going to go ahead and pull the trigger now because I don't like this new model. Or I'm going to get ready that instead of buying the next version of Photoshop, I'm just going to get Pixelmator or Acorn or some other tool that will do what I need it to do, but not be that model. All right, so I want to move on to another thing that happened with Apple and the government again this week. So kind of going back to a little bit of what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. So, you know, they're taking some heat from the DOJ. This week, though, they got a little bit of help from the, of all people, the president, who it's been rumored is actually a pretty good Apple fan, but I'm hoping that didn't play a whole lot into this decision, and I don't think it did. I think it has to do a lot with what's happening with patents and FRAND and things like that. But basically, there was supposed to be a ITC, was it ITC or Federal Trade Commission ban?
No, ITC.
ITC ban on the AT&T versions of the iPhone 4, 3GS, and 3G models. Apple had lost a Samsung thing, and they were supposed to get a ban, and they got a last-minute reprieve. Obama vetoed the action, so Apple is going to be able to continue to bring those in and sell those here in the States.
The devices that are likely to go away at the beginning of September.
Exactly.
Anyway, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I think it more is, like I said, a significantly a win for us saying, hey, you know, we're going to protect what we consider to be these standards essential patents,
right.
And you know, allow this stuff to happen. It's going to be interesting because I think there's supposed to be a ruling here pretty soon going the other way. You know, Apple's fighting for an injunction against some Samsung stuff, but in that case, I don't think there's any FRAND, you know, standards essential patents in play.
They were design patents in Apple's case, not the standards essential. Yeah. I mean, it's really sort of an ugly thing if I understand it. And I can't claim 100% to, but if I get it, basically, if I'm Samsung and I, you know, have this technology and I want it to become a standard patent, or a standard technology, something that everybody can use, I charge everybody less for it. But the deal is I have to charge like everybody.
Right.
So Apple, my competitor, I really can't screw with them because I stand to get money from everybody out there. I can't have like, you know, one kind of rate for Apple a different one for somebody else. And that's where Samsung seems to have gotten in trouble with the White House is in doing that. What I don't understand is how it happened that the ITC thought that was cool.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I was baffled by that. And there were a couple comments. It was because I was trying to understand exactly what was going on here too. And I guess there was a former Wall Street Journal had a former FTC chairman, John Leibowitz, saying, you know, when a company agrees to license what is known as standard essential patents at fair and reasonable terms, it shouldn't be able to ban importation of a product into the United States simply because it wants a better deal. So I guess what was going on here is that Samsung wanted more money from Apple for
right.
some non-essential patents, and then, you know, in this lawsuit fought to basically block this stuff on the basis of these standard essential patents.
Right.
And so that's when the FTC said, well, that's, and Obama said, that's not kosher.
So now you've got a lot of people, you know, writing and saying that this is actually going to, this, I've seen a few stories, a few places that say, well, this could actually really change the landscape on all of the patent fights and all of the lawsuits going on. But I really don't see how, because the whole standard essential patents thing was already in place.
Right.
So, I mean, I would love to think, I mean, maybe everybody's writing with their heart instead of their head, you know, thinking that, oh, good. So maybe like a lot of these lawsuits are going to stop now. Because I don't see them happening. I don't see them stopping at all.
No, I think the only thing that'll stop potentially is companies trying to use those standards essential patents as leverage, which they weren't supposed to do in the first place, as far as I understand. So
you think that'll stop it, huh?
Yeah, I was going to say it took Dad stopping in to get these kids to stop fighting, right? I mean, stepping in, excuse me.
Well,
I mean,
does it just say, though, look, if you're going to go down this path, you know, there's a good chance that we're just going to say no at the end of the whole thing. And so do you even want to fight this fight?
Mm.
Right. I mean, it costs a lot of time and money and effort to bring a lawsuit like this. So if, you know, you can win, quote unquote, win because Samsung won and then still not get what you're going after, or maybe they got what they needed out of it. I don't know. They didn't seem too happy when the veto came through.
The only solution that's going to get rid of this big problem with all these technology companies infighting is for them to make arrangements between each other. I mean, they're litigating this in every country in the world with different results in every country and enforcements and appeals. They're going to spend a lot of money, and at the end of the day, they aren't going to have a lot to show for it. I mean, it would be so much better if they could come to agreements between them and use that money to make better products. But it just doesn't seem like that's the climate right now.
That's a bummer.
Well, and it seems odd to me, and I think it seemed odd to the Federal Trade Commission as well. I mean, even if you're going to... I hate the lawsuit stuff. You know, I think for all those reasons you're just mentioning, it's just, you know, it's a pain. It's a pain in everybody's behind. But, you know, it used to be that what you would go after is some sort of monetary compensation for your lawsuit. And now it seems like most of these are targeted on how can we help get a better sales position in a particular region by blocking our competitors' products.
No, Adam, this is, you know, I try not to talk about legal stuff much because, you know, it's my day job, but right. This has been going on since the beginning of lawsuits. This stuff was always an issue, and it's not always just about money. There's all kinds of motivations for this stuff. It's not just the tech industry.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, they have all decided that, it, you know, they would rather fight it out than try and figure out a solution. And it's too bad because, you know, people like us now have to talk about it, even though all of us are pretty uninformed about it. You know, I'm a lawyer. I don't really know what the heck's going on because it's a full-time job keeping up with it. And at the end of the day, nobody really cares that much. We just want good products.
Right.
You know?
Right. I mean, and as Ken pointed out, it's very interesting. You know, these are the old model iPhones, and chances are in October they're not even going to be available anyway.
Right. Right. So, but it should, as you say, at least with Samsung and Apple, at least in this particular case, at least in this particular market, it should stop Samsung from trying that again. Now, Samsung's actually already gotten, was it Samsung or Motorola that got their hands slapped for the same thing in Europe? So, I mean, one would hope that eventually that would ripple out, but it's going to be a very, very, very long time. Not to denigrate, well, somebody's making money off it.
Lawyers are.
Lawyers are making money off it, right. And I don't want to badmouth lawyers because I hear that there might be one listening right now. But, you know, I mean, somebody is making money off of it. And, you know, if they can then pitch this idea, I mean, there's some area of Samsung. I mean, Apple's got a whole legal department, right? Samsung has a whole legal department. Nokia probably still has a whole legal department. I mean, there's money potentially to be made in doing that. And if they can make the pitch for, I mean, heck, look, this time last year, Apple was awarded almost $1.5 billion. A little bit over $1 billion.
Right.
That's been taken down to just a little over $500 million. And they don't even get to decide whether they're going to get that money until November. And probably there's going to be an appeal after that. But I mean, there is the chance for a big payday. Even for a company the size of Apple, $1 billion is still a lot of money, you know? So
there's a famous quote by Abraham Lincoln, and I want to have it etched in like platinum and hang it in my office. It said, "Half of the practice of an honest lawyer consists of telling his client he's a damn fool." And, you know, and that is absolutely true. After I've been practicing law 20 years now, and so often I have to tell people to stop being crazy. And I think that all these companies are drinking crazy juice about all these lawsuits. And there's not going to be any resolution to this ever from a court. There's no judge on the planet Earth that can swing a gavel and solve this problem, because there's always another court of appeal. And even then, there's always another country and then another country. And the only solution is for these guys to just sit down and say, okay, you want it to bounce when it scrolls to the bottom? Fine, pay us something. You know, and, you know, whatever. I mean, each company has its gripes. And I'm pretty sure that if they all sat down with an effort, they could probably solve it.
Yeah.
I mean, none of these guys are going away. Apple's foolish if they think they can file a lawsuit and get rid of competitors. It's not going to happen. And
think that, or is this just the game that's been created that they all have to play?
Or is this still a holdover from Jobs?
Well, I wouldn't blame it on Jobs. I think just the whole process has an inertia. And once it starts, you know, everybody gets their feelings hurt, and there's an inertia involved here, and somebody has to just stop it. But, you know, I don't know.
Is it Google?
No.
I mean, it seems like they've stayed out of it the most, even though they're not totally out of it.
No, I mean,
you hear about it less, or am I just fooling myself?
Well, who is making the pieces of Android that's got Apple up in arms?
Sure.
I mean, they're not. I mean, Apple's been going after people that make the phones, but the people who design the operating system that's not the people they're suing.
Why are they fighting a proxy war against Google then? I mean, you can say that Samsung did steal some of their design. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that, but. I shouldn't say there's absolutely no question about that. There seems to be a little question about that. But why did Apple never go after Google?
You know, I feel like such a blowhard right now. I don't know. I mean, you know, really.
Well, then I'll tell you why, darn it. And all I right. don't know, because then I'll be the blowhard then. So, no, I have no idea.
Okay. Well, since I brought up Google, let's do something more fun from Google, or interesting to me at the very least, and we'll close out with this. It's a little story. I don't know that there's a lot to talk about here, but I found it very interesting, and it's the Google Chromecast, which I didn't even know about till the darn thing came out and people started shipping them. That's how out of it I was. But it looks like a little USB thumb drive. It's $35 little HDMI thing. It's not USB, it's HDMI. You plug it in the back of your TV, and apparently it lets you stream content from your Chrome browser to your HD TV. And so some people were looking at it as Google's sort of answer to Apple's AirPlay technology, but I think now that it's out and sort of people are taking a look at it, it probably doesn't go that far. You know, it's not, I don't think this is as versatile and robust, at least yet, as AirPlay and Apple TV, but it still kind of interests me a little bit. So do you guys have a thought on this? Did you see this? Do you know anybody who has one?
Eileen Rivera and Tom Merritt have one. Mm-hmm. I know that. And Tom actually seems really excited about it, but I haven't talked to him. So, I mean, it's just like on Twitter every now and then. He seems actually to be kind of stoked about it, but he's kind of a Google guy. I mean, he's more of a geek than I think the digital living room is aimed at.
Right. What was interesting to me about it is, and I don't know how it works with Android devices. I just looked at it mainly from sort of the Mac sort of thing. And so for an Apple user, it looks like the main way you would interact with this thing. And I haven't determined if it's integrated into any Google's apps, but for sure, from your Chrome browser. So say you were bringing up Netflix or you or Hulu or one of these sorts of services, you would stream from the browser from Chrome over to this device, just like you would AirPlay from, you know, iTunes or one of your iOS devices.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm really excited about AirPlay, and it has become a very standard thing in our family. You know, we use it all the time. We just had some friends over the other day that went on a vacation, and they were showing us their vacation pictures from their phone to our Apple TV once I put them on my Wi-Fi. So it's not a geek thing. It's just something to be really excited about. So if Google's figuring out a way to bring that into their ecosystem, you know, more power to them.
Yeah, the only one weird thing that it seemed to me is that I think you have to set up a peer-to-peer Wi-Fi. So I'm not exactly sure how that works.
Yeah, I don't know that much about it, to tell you the truth, Adam. I do know that I love my Apple TV.
Yeah, and well, that was just it. So with the Chromecast thing, it seemed very sort of one way and limited to me, and maybe I'm just totally missing the point. Whereas Apple has made AirPlay so ubiquitous and so robust, and like with you know, the whole screen sharing thing and that being expanded in Mavericks, I'm really excited to see that. As a matter of fact,
So you mean the platform, the company that makes the hardware and the software and the operating system has better integration? What do you mean? I don't understand.
Well, and so the other thing that came up, and I hadn't even thought about this till one of my listeners pointed it out to me, was there was a story that, you know, Apple might be looking at 13-inch and 11-inch tablets, right? Just playing around with this stuff, which we know Apple experiments with form factors and sizes, or we're pretty certain they're doing that sort of stuff all the time.
We hope they are, right?
Yeah, we hope they are. And somebody, after I ran that story, somebody pointed out, you know, with AirPlay and this new, you know, second screen sort of thing, that actually makes a lot of sense, where you could have a larger screen that was connected through AirPlay, and now you're doing your extending your desktop on this 11-inch, 13-inch screen sitting next to your computer, yet it still also functions as a tablet. That's an interesting thing to think about. You know, whether there's a product or a use case for that is a whole nother, you know, conversation to have. But at the very least, that to me was sort of like, oh, that would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, especially with the AirPlay technology. So I don't think it's, you know, the Chromecast, I think what's interesting about it is that Google's doing another piece of hardware, and this one does look pretty useful in some certain scenarios. It's going to be interesting to see how far they take it. Another thing that I've always been curious about, and I need to dig back into this, is wasn't AirPlay supposed to be built on some sort of open standards technology? But it never has ever felt open to me at all.
That wasn't AirPlay. That was, I believe, Messages.
Oh, was it Messages?
Or maybe it wasn't
FaceTime.
Even Messages. FaceTime, right.
Oh.
FaceTime, I think Jobs said within a year when he introduced FaceTime, I believe he said within a year he wanted it to be a standard, and like a standard for all sorts of messaging or all sorts of video conferencing.
Huh.
Which sadly
never really happened.
That was like the last time we heard that was when he said that on stage. And people got really excited, and then people waited, and then people started waiting for an Apple television instead because it was more fun or something else. It never quite did that thing. I want to go back one thing really quickly on Chromecast.
Sure. Yeah.
$35.
Yeah.
That to me is like one of the killer features of it, because I think a lot of people probably bought it not really knowing what they were going to be able to do with it, but $35 is kind of cool.
But there's nothing on it, right? It's just a conduit. There's no apps. There's no...
I honestly don't know, because while $35 almost sounded cool enough to get me to go to Best Buy, it didn't. I mean, you know, I'll be curious to see what other people have to say about it. And if I happen to be in the store and there happens to be one there and I happen to have a little extra money, I might go ahead and do it. But I mean, they priced it exceptionally well. I mean, it feels like a hobby device in a way that, honestly, Apple TV, that when Apple TV came out and it was $99, I mean, that's like, it's practically like Apple giving something away. A charger for my MacBook is $80, but they were going to give me an Apple TV for $99. I mean, that's like, that practically is a hobby price for that too. So, I mean, the Chromecast coming out at $35, I would imagine there were a lot of people that just bought it because that sounds neat and it's $35, as opposed to, well, that sounds neat and it's $200.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so if they're able to sort of like grow it from there, kind of the way Apple has with Apple TV and the $99. Yeah. It's kind of a neat thing. I mean, certainly better than what was the Google TV device that they came out with that was horrendously expensive, and people put it on order and it ended up not shipping, and they gave them money for something
right,
else little, and their money
little,
back.
That little
Nexus,
sort of
like
square
Nexus
box.
Q or something.
Yes.
And or yeah. Q something. I can't remember.
Well, and then before that, they had the Google TV system that Logitech made these weird devices for and nobody bought. I mean, this is not the first attempt.
But it's an excellent attempt because they're saying, look, really, it's nothing. Here, it's nothing. I'm going to charge you almost nothing for this because here, this is our hobby. I mean, basically, they're kind of doing the Apple thing again, except for they're hiding it. Although one of the big gripes that people had, and this is how you can tell that the early adopters were very much geeks, which is fine. I guess some of my best friends are geeks. They kept showing it plugged into the back of a TV with, you know, nothing to it. Well, it turns out you had to have an HDMI port that powered a device, which most of them don't. So then you had to actually plug it into the wall with a cord. And a lot of people were very upset by that because, you know, everything was about how small it is and how sleek it is. Now you just plug it into the back of your TV, no cords, no cables. Oh, you don't have a powered HD. Okay, well, then you do need a cord or a cable. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. I felt kind of bad for them because, I mean, I'm like, seriously, it's $35. They basically sold you a toy. And you're upset that the batteries aren't included. Come on.
I think it's just interesting to watch these big tech companies try to innovate on TV in a climate where the content providers have, it looks like, little or no interest in working with them. So, I mean, Apple TV, Chromecast, these are all products that are made to kind of get around that.
Well,
but that's another podcast.
It's probably another podcast, but again, more and more of the content, I think, is starting to try and get around that model too.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what we saw with, you know, the stuff that Netflix is doing. I think I just read this past week or maybe last week that Hulu's looking into producing their own original content now. I mean, I think this is long-term the future, and Google certainly wants to be a player in this space, and this is one little foray into it. So I guess this is Google's hobby now, right? Now they've got their TV hobby. I mean, they played around in TV before with Google TV and that, like you were saying, Ken, that Nexus Q box and stuff like that. But this seems like one that's actually gaining some traction, and consumers are responding pretty positively to it. I just saw a lot of positive takes on this. You know, most of them from the Apple community saying, hey, this isn't a threat to Apple TV, but I think it's still an interesting new player in this sort of, I don't know if you can technically call this a set-top box, but it's in essence in that set-top box market space, right?
Well, the other thing to consider, too, is all the live channel stuff that YouTube is starting to do now.
Right.
They just this week, I think, busted down to if you have 100 subscribers. It used to be if you had 1,000 subscribers, you had access to YouTube Live. Now it's if you have 100 subscribers, you have access to that. And as jokey, you know, as dumb, like, you know, guy getting hit in the groin with a football and, you know, cute videos of kittens. YouTube is ubiquitous. I mean, it's everywhere. It's on my phone. It's on my iPad. It's on your computer. Kids. Dave told us last time that we did this. His kids don't turn on the TV. They go to YouTube.
Right.
And if YouTube can actually be free, if YouTube can actually be up to the minute, I mean, if YouTube... I mean, there's money there. There's money there for some real content providers to start streaming a channel, even if it's a special channel, even if it's only like, what was that thing that Clayton used to have Gadgets and Games on? It was like some weird internet 8 hours a day thing that Fox had.
Right, Fox Live channel or something like that. Yeah.
Something along those lines, yeah. I mean, once he quit doing Gadgets and Games, I pretty much quit paying attention to what it was. But I mean, so a few ads, okay, plus the ads that YouTube has built in, and make that easy to stream to your Chromecast, and suddenly you've got something, you know, kind of interesting there. Well, I shouldn't say suddenly, but...
That would be very interesting, except I have to point out the one thing I read, and this came from iMore, because they've been playing around with the Chromecast. Somebody in the Android Central forums, according to them, said that currently you cannot stream live YouTube events to your Google Chromecast, which is just bizarre.
Well, you know, we'll see.
I'm sure that'll change, but these are the kinds of things sometimes that Google does that you just scratch your head. It's like, Google does own YouTube, right? Oh, yeah, they own YouTube. And this is their product, right? Yeah, yeah. Okay. And probably big reason people want to have this is for this live stuff. Yeah. Well, it doesn't work.
Well, if Google has a garden, you know, a TV garden, the first few times they put seeds in the ground, nothing sprouted. You know, this time something has. So we'll see where it goes.
It'll be very interesting to see where it goes. And I'm totally with you, Ken. I mean, if I've got an extra $35, it's an easy thing to shell out a couple, pence for and check it out, see what it does.
I have an old TV. I've used my two HDMI ports, so I'm out.
Oh, I think I've got two more left open.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I could do that and a Roku box.
All right, so the deal is the first one of us to get one of these has to come back on and give a report. But we'll save that for another time. So I want to thank both of you for coming on and hanging out and chatting again. This is always fun. I'm glad we're able to do this on a somewhat regular basis, and I'm sure we'll get you back on in another month or two. Is that cool?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome.
Just tell me when. You're my captain. Just point the direction. I'll sail.
All right. So real quickly, let everybody know where they can find your shows, what you're up to. We'll start with you, Dave.
You can find me at MacSparky.com, and that points to the podcast, MacPowerUsers.com. And if you want to get better at your Macs and iOS stuff, check out my field guides. I've got a Markdown one, a paperless one, and a Mac Tips one out now. And maybe, well, probably not within a month, but within a couple months, I'll have another one for everybody.
Ooh, cool. A little teaser.
Yeah.
And you, Ken?
MacOSKen.com is the best place to find me, I suppose. I'm also on Twitter at MacOSKen. I do a daily Apple news-related Apple news podcast called MacOSKen. And if you like your geekery with a bit of sci-fi, I also do a Star Trek podcast with my friend John Champion called Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast. And yeah, because I found that I was getting far too popular, you know, only being able to talk about Apple at parties. So now I can talk about Apple and Star Trek at parties.
I have to tell you, I was at a party and talking to a friend who is a discovered podcasts, and he's not a geek, or at least not a computer geek. And he's telling me, I said, well, what podcast do you follow? And he told me, he says, well, my favorite one, he says, I know this sounds really stupid, it's the Star Trek podcast. And they go through every episode and they do a whole show on it.
You're kidding
me.
And
I said, did you know that I'm friends with Ken Ray? And it's like, you could just see my stock just shot up in his view. I mean, I felt really? So special that day. I wanted to send you flowers or something. I don't know.
Wow. That's kind of cool. That's very cool. Yeah, no, I'm glad he was one of the people who's okay with me. Because I'm kind of, forgive me, we're going to Vegas here to do the Star Trek convention, like later this week.
Yeah, and people, if they're going to be there, they should stay hiding.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Come find us. We'll be, we're doing a panel on Friday at 3:40 in the DeForest Kelly Theater, just about Mission Log. And then we're also going to be hanging out at the Roddenberry Entertainment Table, at least part of the day, all 4 days. But I'm fairly convinced that what's going to happen actually is we're going to end up with two warring factions, because it turns out we get lots of emails saying Ken's crazy and John's right, and then we get some other emails saying John's crazy and Ken's right. And I'm afraid that it's going to end up being a fight. Hopefully, it'll actually end up being a love-in, but it may, you know, it may come to blows. So I'm glad your guy was one of my guys.
Oh, I'm not sure. I think he wanted to ship you two. I'm pretty sure.
He wanted what?
Have you heard of shipping?
No.
See, I'm so hip. My kids just taught me this. I guess when you go to conventions and you have like characters on a TV show or people in a band and you think they should have a relationship together,
yeah,
you say you want to ship them. I think they want to ship you.
Wow. Okay.
I don't know what that means.
I don't
look
either.
Look it up. Have some teenagers.
Urban Dictionary.
You guys need to get some teenagers around you.
Some teenagers.
Let me just get a couple of those. Can you buy them from Amazon Prime?
They're really expensive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I hear they're going, yeah, never mind. I forget.
All right.
That's up in the Urban Dictionary.
We better wrap this up. All right. Thank you both. It's a great show.
All right, take care.
So there you go, Dave Sparks and Ken Ray. Again, thank you to them for coming on and chatting with us. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment, though, and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, make sure you check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label, along with PDF Pen for your iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch for iOS. You can get free trials of Smile's Mac applications, as well as more information and details on all the stuff they make over at smilesoftware.com. Connected Data, makers of the Transporter, it is a private cloud storage system. You get all the benefits of the cloud, but with the control and security of a physical hard drive or NAS. You should really check it out, and you can get 10% off your own Transporter by using the offer code MACCAST. So head over to filetransporter.com/MACCAST to check it all out. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And Squarespace, it's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code MACCAST8. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed. Every week, I look forward to your comments, your questions, and your emails. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also leave voicemail on the voicemail line. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or on Skype. You can use the Skype address, the MacCast, and leave voicemail there. If you need the show notes with links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast, or on Google Plus. There is a MacCast community. Just search for MacCast, and I'm sure you'll find it, or I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.